This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran slams some Western politicians, including former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, for participating in the annual meeting of the Mujahideen Khalq Organization terror group. U.S. forces come under a mortar attack in the Syrian province of Deir ez-Zor, the latest in a series of attacks on American troops in Iraq and Syria in recent days. And a new poll shows that, for the first time, a majority of Brazilians support impeachment of President Jair Bolsonaro. Welcome to the program. Our top story, Tehran slams Western countries for supporting and participating in the annual meeting of the Mujahideen Khalq Organization terror group. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said the MKO is a terrorist cult that has the blood of Iranian people on its hands. Said Khatibzadeh slammed Western politicians, including former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, for, quote, selling themselves to the European or to the Europe-hosted circus. He accused the West of a shameful hypocrisy driven by insatiable thirst for money and anti-Iran obsession. The MKO's three-day virtual meeting, which began in Paris Saturday, is attended by Pompeo and several U.S. lawmakers, as well as Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša. Every year, the event brings together delegates paid by the terror group. The MKO has carried out assassination and bombing campaigns against Iranians since the country's Islamic Revolution of 1979.
The Mujahideen Khalq Organization was founded in the 1960s. The group started the blind assassination campaign of Iranian citizens and officials after the 1979 Islamic Revolution in a bid to overturn the Islamic establishment and control the country. They also conducted dozens of bombings across Iran. Out of nearly 17,000 Iranians killed in different terrorist attacks over the past four decades, about 12,000 of them have fallen victim to the group's acts of terror. Former Iranian President Mohammad Ali Rajoi and ex-Prime Minister Mohammad Javad Bahonar are among those killed in the MKO terror attacks. The group is also responsible for a massive blast targeting the headquarters of the Islamic Republic Party on June 28, 1981 in Tehran. At least 72 senior Iranian officials and lawmakers, including then-Judiciary Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Ali Beheshti, lost their lives in the bombing. The MKO is also behind a failed assassination attempt on the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in 1981. During a war launched against Iran by former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s, MKO members were armed by then the Iraqi regime and prepared them to fight alongside Baathist forces against the Islamic Republic. Despite all crimes committed by the MKO, it is not currently listed by any Western country as a terrorist organization. The European Union and the US, that often claim to be against any form of terrorism, rather removed the MKO from their lists of terror organizations in 2009 and 2012, respectively. Ever since, the West has changed its stance toward the MKO, propagating it not only as an Iranian opposition group, but misses no chance to fund the group and lobby in its favor. The MKO throws lavish conferences every year in the French capital, Paris, with well-known American, Western, and Saudi figures in attendance as guests of honor. Some of these figures who attend these events include former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton, former Mayor of New York City Rudy Giuliani, former Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper, and former Saudi spy chief Prince Turki bin Faisal Al Saud. The MKO is currently based in Albania, where it enjoys freedom of activities despite being involved in taking thousands of innocent Iranian lives and plotting terrorist attacks for decades.
Moving on, political commentator Mrs. Zafar Bangai says Western countries will support and finance any terrorist group that advances their agenda.
Basically, what this reflects is the hypocrisy that exists in the West. Any terrorist that advance the West's agenda against its perceived enemies, the West would support them. We find this situation with the MKO terrorists that have been used by the West against the Islamic Republic of Iran for decades, as well as we see this similar situation with ISIS terrorists in Syria, Iraq, and other places that are doing the West's dirty work. So it is very revealing that on the one hand, while Western regimes, whether it's in the United States, Britain, France, Germany, etc., on the one hand, they talk about human rights and the right to life, and on the other hand, they finance and propagate the propaganda of this terrorist organization that has perpetrated horrendous crimes against the people of Iran, including the assassination of leading figures of the Islamic Revolution. So essentially, the MKO is used by the West, and in particular by the United States, and an instrument or a tool in order to undermine the Islamic Republic of Iran.
U.S. forces have come under fire in the eastern Syrian province of Deir ez-Zor. A war monitor said a mortar shell landed in the Conoco gas field where American troops are stationed. A U.S. military official said the incident left no casualties or damage. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for the attack. American troops have recently been targeted in Syria following last month's U.S. airstrikes against resistance groups on the Iraqi-Syrian border. Washington hasn't obtained Damascus's permission to deploy troops in Syria. Syrian government has denounced U.S. takeover of the Arab country's oil fields. Syria hails the adoption of a resolution by the UN for the continued entry of humanitarian aid into the country through Turkey. The Syrian foreign minister described the resolution as an achievement, saying it involves all aspects which Western countries refuse to include. Faisal Mirdad stressed that the delivery of aid must take place from inside Syria and not only through border crossings. He said the resolution also gets Syria to be aware of everything which enters the country and where this aid is going, making it difficult for the Western countries to pass weapons to terrorists. The UN Security Council on Friday extended aid activity at the Bab al-Hawa border crossing with Turkey, through which essential humanitarian supplies reaches Syria. And now, the armed wing of Islamic Jihad movement in Palestine has held a summer camp for Gazan teenagers with the main goal of raising their awareness about the Palestinian cause. Ruba Shabit reports.
More than 2,000 Palestinian teenagers have attended a summer camp held by the Islamic Jihad armed wing to get more familiar with the Palestinian cause and receive due military training for possible confrontation with the Israeli army.
The camp aims to raise the awareness of the Gaza teenagers about the Palestinian cause. Israeli regime thinks that by waging war, it can undermine the spirit of our nation. Camps like this make our children prepared to stand up for their rights against the Zionist violence.
The camp was inaugurated in a ceremony attended by a number of political and military leaders of the Islamic Jihad movement. The leaders said the camp seeks to make the new generation more familiar with the Palestinian cause and demolish the concept of normalizing ties with Israel in their minds.
This camp aims to give training to the young generation on the resistance front's war strategies against the Israeli regime. A number of participants have lost one or more relatives during the latest escalation, and they are here to learn how to cope with the next atrocities.
The number of participants this year was significantly higher compared to previous years. The resistance factions attribute this huge participation to the big victory they achieved against Israel in the last escalation over the Strip.
We came here to learn how to defend our lands. We want history to write about us and how we seek to liberate Jerusalem al-Quds. My message to the Israeli occupation is that the youngest olive tree in our land is older than your whole entity. We are the generation that witnessed wars and killings, and that's why we will keep the resistance and will not give up our land.
The Islamic Jihad says these camps also carry a message to Israel that the Palestinian factions are always ready to defend their rights. Observers here say among its responsibilities, the resistance front should narrate the true history of resistance for new generations to help them understand the true face of the Israeli regime. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says Israel has demolished over 420 Palestinian homes so far this year. The UN agency said in a report that the number included 130 donor-funded Palestinian-owned structures in the occupied West Bank. It also stated that nearly 600 people, including some 320 children, have been displaced due to these demolitions and seizures of Palestinian homes. The report indicated that the number of structures targeted has increased by 24% compared to the same period last year. Rights groups say Israeli demolitions are part of a long-running land grab policy to make room for new settlements. Italian riot police clashed with protesters trying to reach the venue of the G20 finance ministers' meeting in the city of Venice. More than 250 policemen were dispatched to prevent possible violence by the demonstrators. A number of arrests were also made. The protesters voiced anger at the finance ministers and their policies. Their first face-to-face meeting since the start of the coronavirus pandemic, the G20 ministers endorsed a deal to put the minimum corporate tax rate at 15%. The move is expected to bring back billions of dollars of funds to governments straining under the pandemic. To another one of our headline stories this hour, an opinion poll shows that a majority of Brazilians support impeaching President Jair Bolsonaro. According to the survey conducted by Datafolha, 50% of Brazilians support a proposed move by the country's lower house to open impeachment proceedings, while 42% oppose it. People have been holding protests across Brazil for months, as you may know, slamming the president's handling of the coronavirus pandemic. Last week, a Supreme Court judge authorized an investigation into Bolsonaro for dereliction of duty over procuring an Indian COVID-19 vaccine. Suspicions of overpricing and corruption related to the contract have been cited for the allegation. Brazil has the world's second highest COVID death toll, with nearly 533,000 fatalities. On Saturday, Brazil registered more than 48,000 new daily cases, with over 1,200 deaths. On that story, I'm going to bring in Mr. Bruno Biclini. He's a political scientist and a professor of international relations who joins us via Skype out of the city of Porto Alegre. Thank you very much, Professor, for joining our broadcast. I want to get your reaction to this latest development and that opinion poll. What does that tell you?
Well, we can affirm that Jair Bolsonaro's basis and support and legitimacy is disintegrating. The poll does not reveal the worst part of the scenario in Brazil, is that we have 6,175 professional military people, military officers, inside the civilian government. And what are they doing? They are supporting Bolsonaro escalation to threaten democratic institutions. For example, this week, the defense minister and the whole commanders-in-chief of the army, the navy, and the air force. And the day after this, the commander of the Air Force, they threatened the Congress and they threatened democracy in Brazil. They are not saying we are going to do a coup d'etat, but they are threatening because they do have some colonels, some lieutenants and colonels inside the health ministry, very, very committed, I would say, for suspicious about the Indian vaccine and other, I would say, mystery negotiations. So we do have a polarized society, but the right wing and the right wingers in Brazil, they are splitted. They are not even, maybe a half of them still support Bolsonaro, and 55, 57, 61% does not rely on Bolsonaro. He's not a reliable man, a reliable person in Brazil. He is disintegrating as long as he proposes to disintegrate Brazil as we conceive Brazil.
Help us understand, Professor, how serious, because what I just read was the result of a poll, but at the same time, there is this move by the country's lower house of parliament. Help us understand this better. How much of a say do they have in impeaching the president? How serious of a case do you think the judge's investigation order can get for the president? Or are we just looking at, you know, figures and numbers that do not necessarily end in the president's impeachment?
There is a chance. There's a real chance. I will try to explain how. Bolsonaro do have the majority in the Congress, representatives and Senate. But we have in Brazil a very bad tradition of oligarchic and physiological politics. They call this the center of the politics. It's a right-wing oligarch, bitka, bunch keepers, pork barrel politicians. And those pork barrel politicians, they are very afraid about the investigations because they were disputing or kind of fighting for positions inside the health ministry. And this is going to national TV broadcast because the investigations held by the Senate, they are being admired and being followed by 500 people, 1 million people. It's a phenomenon of social media in Brazil and social culture. So they have a real threat about Bolsonaro government. But I must say this, he still do have the majority in the armed forces, the majority inside the parliament, and at least half of the right-wing voters in Brazil.
All right, many, many thanks. That's Bruno Biclini, political scientist and professor of international relations out of Porto Alegre, Brazil. Professor, I'm going to let you go, and enjoy your time in Porto Alegre.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
With the Olympics weeks away, time is running out, but there are still important precautions that could be implemented to avoid a worst-case COVID-19 super-spreader scenario. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Lisa M. Brusso, author. This article is published under the heading Olympics, Unanswered Questions About Serious COVID-19 Risks. Stay tuned for more. With the Olympics weeks away, time is running out, but there are still important precautions that could be implemented to avoid a worst-case COVID-19 super-spreader scenario. Yet, the International Olympics Committee, IOC, continues to give at best cavalier attention to the problem of the viral transmission. When the IOC made the decision to postpone the Olympics in March 2020, there were fewer than 350,000 COVID-19 cases in the entire world. Today, more than that number, some 370,000 are infected each day. In March 2020, COVID-19 had killed fewer than 15,000 people. Last week, COVID-19 killed at least 57,000 people, and that was the lowest weekly death toll since November 2020. Efforts to combat the pandemic remain precarious, with COVID-19 cases increasing in much of the world. The IOC has repeatedly invoked the mantra that 80% of those in Olympic Village will be vaccinated, but that will not be true of the many volunteers, workers, and spectators in poorly vaccinated Japan, nor will it be enough. Moreover, the IOC says nothing about the variability in vaccine effectiveness. Several countries that rely mainly on vaccine have experienced recent surges in infections, probably due to the ability of the highly transmissible Delta variant, which has become dominant in many countries, to evade the vaccine. Separately, a Ugandan athlete and coach tested positive for COVID-19 upon entry into Japan, both fully vaccinated. Although one would think that the IOC would be particularly sensitive to differences among sports, its risk assessments fail to distinguish among competitions. One-on-one competitions involving close conduct and conducted indoors carry a much higher risk than single competitor events. Wrestling is riskier than weightlifting. Boxing is riskier than badminton. Thomas Bach, PhD, IOC president and gold medalist in fencing, should understand that fencers have a much higher risk of spreading COVID-19 than track and field athletes. The risk of transmission increases with the number of potential sources, the quantity and closeness of contacts, and the time spent in a shared space. It also varies by the nature of different sports. At least daily testing of everyone in the medium and high-risk categories could help to decrease the chance of infectious people being present. To make this work, however, the IOC would need to include everyone in these categories, including the officials, workers, and volunteers. Instead, the IOC is doing only daily testing on athletes whom it deems at risk, without explanation of at risk. Daily testing only works if the test is specific and sensitive and if the results are variable quickly. Within a few hours, even with those caveats, testing cannot be relied upon to pick up every possible infected person in a timely manner. What the IOC recommends is based on a now superseded understanding of how COVID spreads, as if it is transmitted only by large droplets that fall to earth quickly rather than small particles that linger and spread in the air. So the IOC recommends face coverings, even though they do not limit emission or inhalation of small infectious particles. Barriers, even though they do not stop the dispersion of small infectious particles, opening a window every 30 minutes, which is hardly sufficient to lower the concentration of infectious particles in dorm or dining rooms. Notably, air conditioning is not ventilation. Making air colder and moving it around the room is not the same as exchanging new air with old. Rather, it simply distributes an increasing particle concentration throughout the space, which could ensure that everyone in that space inhales an infectious dose, as demonstrated early in the pandemic during the now infamous Guangzhou restaurant outbreak. Stadiums control both spectators and athletes by channeling them through small corridors. Tunnels and corridors, including hotel hallways, are risky places of high density but low ventilation. An urgent risk assessment and review of all environments where athletes, support staff, workers, and spectators will congregate is needed to minimize the risk of exposure. To help the IOC with the basic precautionary steps that it seems unable to take on its own, we pose the following questions. What is the response plan if there is an outbreak of COVID-19 during the Games? Why isn't daily testing being conducted on everyone with potential for close contacts using PCR-based testing? Will there be genomic testing to better understand who infected whom and to prepare countries as athletes return? What has been done to evaluate the quality of ventilation in all venues and locations throughout the Olympic Village and venues? What has been done to implement air filtration in all venues and locations throughout the Olympic Village and indoor venues in all areas where ventilation is inadequate? Are there enough resources in the Olympic Village to manage a large outbreak? How will a readily available supply of approved masks be obtained and distributed to athletes? Will workers and others required to spend lots of time in close contact with many people be provided with fit-tested respirators to ensure that they are adequately protected from an infectious dose? How is the IOC updating the Olympic Village and venues in light of the new variants, especially the Delta variant? The best case scenario, the Olympics happen safely, a cause for great global celebration. Worst case scenario, Tokyo 2020 becomes a global mega spreader event, setting a world record for pandemic acceleration. What happens in Tokyo won't stay in Tokyo. For better or worse, the Olympics will affect all of us. The IOC needs to get its corporate act together for the sake of the public and global consequences.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm your humble host, Muzaffar Haider. Here in the studio today, we have with us Sayyid Mahdi and Sheikh Ali. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So, Iranian elections. We're living in exciting times.
Very.
We have a new president sworn in, alhamdulillah. Has he sworn in yet?
No, not yet. August.
Uh-huh. August, okay. Oh, wow, okay.
Yes.
So, we've got these new elections. You know, he's won by a landslide. And despite all, you know, the coronavirus and everything and all the difficulties, the propaganda as well, which we're going to talk about, inshallah, he still won by a landslide against all the other opponents, which is fantastic, alhamdulillah. I was wondering, you know, about this Western propaganda, what are they doing and why?
Well, thanks for the opportunity. It's an important and interesting topic to analyze, to discuss, and I think we would invite all our listeners to think strategically, think bigger than just reading news and coming to conclusions. One of the things that's happening is like the enemy wants to and has been wanting to since the inception of the Islamic Republic and this Islamic system. They've been trying to prove that it's some sort of a dictatorship, some sort of a, you know, a monarchy, a religious...
And they've been trying this all the way back since Imam Khomeini's time.
Right. And why are they trying to do this? Because they are attempting to and have been attempting to discredit the system, right? While there are other dictatorships, like the real dictatorships, where the people have zero say in what type of system they have, who rules them, what type of management they have, what happens with their resources.
But they're the best of buddies.
Exactly.
They never
get brought up, right?
Right.
Why Islamic Republic of Iran is the target of the Western media, of the West? It is because this system creates hurdles for the West to be able to accomplish their goals, their whims and wishes, which are to their benefit only and not for the benefit of the people of this region.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, especially when it comes to Iran, Iran has been opposing and exposing Western governments, and especially the United States of America, Britain, Germany, France, you know, and especially something that is not a government, an illegal entity, the Zionist regime of Israel. Iran has been busy exposing their plots in the region. Right, how they're manipulating the population, how they are taking control of the entire region, and what their evil plans are. This is why they hate Iran.
And promoting a culture of active resistance against the hegemonic power.
And it has worked. Mm. You know, above everything, it has worked.
Right.
So now their propaganda is at its peak, right? They want to prove that, okay, you know, this is a mullah dictatorship. You've seen all those, you know, verbiage that they use, that filthy verbiage that they try to use in the so-called mainstream media to change people's perception and perspective of what Iran really is. Iran, on the other hand, alhamdulillah, it has been a successful model where not only the management of the country, starting from the Wali al-Faqih down to, like, you know, the local representatives of the people, they are elected or selected or supported by the people. That's one strength of this divine system. The other thing is that people are not ready to take any other system other than the Islamic system of Wilayat al-Faqih. So these two things they've become like a thorn in the eye of the enemy.
Yeah, I mean, on the one side, these guys are opposing us, and on the other side, they're popular.
Yeah.
That it's okay if you can you can oppose us all you want as long as you're unpopular.
Yeah.
But as soon as you're popular, that's just,
you know, Imam
Khomeini,
Imam Khamenei rather, he once said, that their attacks are not on me as a person, you know. Their attacks are at all of us. That includes me and that includes you and other officials and the country itself government and our systems, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is actually a message that I wish Muslims generally would understand. It's not an attack on a particular Muslim. It's not an attack on that version of Islam or this version of Islam. It's an attack on all of us as an ummah.
Right.
I want to come back to you, Sheikh Ali, but Sayyid Mahdi, you're a person who reads the news. You're often looking at the updates and you're researching. So I'd like to ask you, what kind of propaganda are these predominantly Western entities spewing out?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yeah, I mean, I don't pay that much attention to the news, but yeah, I go through the news. It's good for everybody to read the news, stay up to date on current events, make sure they know what's going on in the geopolitical, socio-political arena. It's an integral and critical part of being a human being, and especially it's something that is emphasized in Islam. Right, is that you should know what's going on, not just with the other Muslims across the world, but, you know, what's going on in the world in general.
Mm-hmm.
And so with that in mind, you know, it's good to read the news. Be careful what news you read, of course. Not all sources are trustworthy sources. Be careful where you're getting your news from. And definitely be careful of mass media and these guys
as
well.
Of course, but then when it comes to the elections particularly, what are the kinds of slogans?
Yeah, so when it comes to the elections, you will find that there has been a very severe attack on the personality of the president-elect, Sayyid Raisi, Ibrahim Raisi. And a lot of different things have come out about him. If you do, again, a little bit of research, you will find that a lot of it, if not all of it, is false. It is not just
like
propaganda,
kind of
it's lies. So again, right, so there's a lot of propaganda against the persona of Ibrahim Raisi. And, of course, the propaganda is there in order to, you know, make him look like a bad guy. Now, why do they want him to look like a bad guy? Because, interestingly, all of the achievements and accomplishments and the line that Sayyid Ibrahim Raisi has taken up to this point in his life is a revolutionary stance. It is the stance of the Islamic Revolution. It is a stance which follows the path of Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Muslim Ummah. And also it is a stance that follows, of course, the founding father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini. And so because the enemies of Islam, enemies of humanity, the enemies of common sense, if you want to say, they have seen that this individual is walking the path of Imam Khamenei, he is walking the path of Imam Khomeini, and it is because of his walking on this path that they are coming up with these vicious lies against this individual.
Sheikh Ali, back to you.
So when you look at the president-elect Ayatollah Raisi, right, he won by a landslide victory, right? So this is like one of the things that gives us a few messages. One of the message is that people, since the entire Iran at least, and of course the enemies, they know him. People know that he's revolutionary. He's committed to Islam. He's committed to the betterment of the people of this region, not only in Iran, while he has mostly to do, other than the foreign policy, he has to do with Iran, right? But they know that he's sincere, he's honest, he's been in judiciary where they have seen him deliver, right? Where they have seen him perform, where they have seen him make improvements, and also, like, you know, break many mafias that exist or existed in Iran. So now they're like, okay, he has won. What do we do about it, right? This is the voice of the people. The people elected him. The people voted for him. The people came out while there was coronavirus going on. You know, everybody is, even the elderly, you know, since they're more vulnerable, they saw it to be their responsibility to come out and decide their own fate by electing Sayyid Raisi. Now the enemy is baffled. They're like, okay, it's people's choice, people's voice. People of Iran has elected him, and he has won by landslide, right? So it's not like you can say, oh, it was like, you know, just 1,000 votes away from, you know, the other guy, you know, who is subservient to the West.
As often is the case in other countries.
So now they're like, okay, what do we do? This is where the propaganda comes in. Remember, Sayyid Raisi has a lot of enemies, right? Not only the West, even internally, if you look at, let's assume that you are a judge, and you end up breaking these mafias who are corrupt. Right, and they're running their show, they're just stealing money and looting the wealth of the country, and you, being that chief justice, right, you decide against them, right? You penalize them, you throw them in jails, for instance.
You're
right?
Going to create lots of enemies.
In other words, you implement justice from the life of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
That's what
you
reminded me of,
right?
As well. Yeah.
You implement justice, you're going to make enemies. This is what he's facing. He has all those big mafias and all those big, huge, resourceful cults that don't like him. So of course you're going to have this propaganda, right?
Right.
On one hand, we have West, who are doing it for the ideological reasons, right? They want to show that the Islamic Republic is, you know, a hoax, you know, people don't support the system.
I mean, let's be honest. They do this every time, don't they?
In terms of Iran, yes, they do it all the time. This is something that has been high on their agenda. And I would say, like, in some sense, they've been successful because our media is weak. Because we're not reaching out to people. They don't know the facts. People don't know Farsi. People don't know Persian. When they go out to read news, like Sayyid, right, where do they go? Alhamdulillah, he knows Farsi, so he can compare and contrast. But average people around the world, all they have is like BBC, Fox, and CNN, and Voice of America, which are nothing but propaganda, right?
Nothing
even
but
even their underlying messages, even their subtle messages, you know, the choice of words that they have,
right.
It's all, you know, you can see if you're a bit smart, you can see how they're trying to fool the masses, right? Sayyid Raisi is the popular president that Iran has now. And the best thing is the population of Iran is not only expecting results from him, they're also supporting him. You know, sometimes it is like, you know, you sit on the sidelines and you sit on the fence and you go like, well, you're the president now, just deliver. You know, we're just sitting here watching and waiting. No, Iranians are different. This nation is different. They are ready to support Sayyid Raisi in every way possible,
and
right?
And help him, like...
And one of the examples of that would be, you know how the leader, Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei, he keeps saying that we need economy of resistance, right?
Right.
We need to grow this internal growth of businesses and factories and stuff.
Right.
People are ready to invest, provided they're given the right platform and opportunity, which Sayyid Raisi is, inshallah, going
to
provide.
Right.
People are
inshallah.
Ready to invest in businesses, in local businesses, in domestic capabilities, and using those capabilities to grow
self-reliance
the Islamic system.
And not depending on other countries, especially the Western powers.
If you look at another strength that Sayyid Raisi has is, after he won the elections, you look at, and the leader has brought up this point, you look at America, what happened? Trump lost, and then what happened? It was a fiasco, right? It was a chaos, right? You saw, like, all the protests that took place and so on and so forth, right? Just this recent episode. We can go in the history and dissect it, too, but just take this recent episode. In Iran, you know what transpired, which the media does not put forth, is that the previous president, Rouhani, he congratulated Sayyid Raisi. They sat down, they had meetings. After his party has lost at the hands of Sayyid Raisi, they sit down, they discuss the future of the country. Where have you seen this happen?
And
normally, if one party wins, the other party is like, you know, protesting, and they're saying, oh, the elections are,
this,
you know,
this idea of working together, this united front, it's a beautiful thing. I want to discuss it more, inshallah, perhaps in future episodes. For now, we've run out of time. We hope that you benefited from the show, inshallah, from myself, from Sayyid Mahdi, and from Sheikh Ali. We bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parstoday.com, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye.
A symphony of nature. Oh, it's taking my breath away. I'm so blessed out here today, yeah. Allah, oh Allah, 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 Allah. I see the sun, the stars, the moon. I join them all in praising you. Allah, oh Allah, 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 Allah. I feel alive and I feel so good. I feel so close to you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Investigator Perry Kay jammed the brakes of his government-issued vehicle to survey the offence. "Oh, this doesn't look too good. Let's take a peek," he said, exiting the car to handle what has become one of the most existential violations in drought-stricken Las Vegas: a faulty sprinkler. Perry Kay is one of nearly 50 water waste investigators deployed by the local water authority to crack down on even the smallest misuse of a liquid perilously scarce in western United States, desiccated by two decades of drought. The situation in Las Vegas, Nevada, which went a record 240 consecutive days without rain last year, is increasingly severe. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Oliver Millman. The piece is titled, "We Live in a Desert, We Have to Act Like It. Las Vegas Faces Reality of Drought." Stay with us for more of Oliver Millman's article. Investigator Perry Kay jammed the brakes of his government-issued vehicle to survey the offence. "Oh, this doesn't look too good. Let's take a peek," he said, exiting the car to handle what has become one of the most existential violations in drought-stricken Las Vegas: a faulty sprinkler. Perry Kay is one of nearly 50 water waste investigators deployed by the local water authority to crack down on even the smallest misuse of a liquid perilously scarce in western United States, desiccated by two decades of drought. The situation in Las Vegas, Nevada, which went a record 240 consecutive days without rain last year, is increasingly severe. Lake Mead, the vast reservoir that supplies Las Vegas with 90% of its water, has now plummeted to a historic low, meaning Nevada faces the first ever mandatory reduction in its water supply next year. This looming cutback is forcing restrictions upon the city that has somehow managed to thrive as a gaudy oasis in the baking Mojave Desert. The lake isn't getting any fuller at this time, so we need to conserve every single drop of water, said Kay, an energetic former US Air Force serviceman who wears a Rivas vest and brandishes a badge as he does his rounds searching for violators. He starts his shift at 4 a.m. A lot of people think because we are government workers, we are not out there at that time, but we are out 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, every day of the year, he said. Kay regularly hands out fines. They start at $80 and then double for each further offense, for the sort of rule-breaking he has spotted in Summerlin, a wealthy Las Vegas enclave where landscapers tend manicured grounds in the soaring heat. Water sprayed onto lawns and plants isn't allowed to flow off the property, but that day a damaged sprinkler had caused water to cascade into the gutter, where the precious resource is lost. Look, we've got a little creek or stream here, said Perry Kay as he used his phone to video the water snaking onto the road. If everyone did this, quite a bit of water would be wasted. It's so hot in Las Vegas, this July day's temperature will reach 40 degrees Celsius or 104 degrees Fahrenheit, that the errant water will evaporate within 5 minutes. Perry Kay planted a yellow flag next to the leak as a warning to the homeowners, but a few taps on the computer mounted in his car shows this property has a previous warning, so an $80 fine will be on its way. There's a growing realization, however, that such rules, no watering between 11 a.m. and 7 p.m, none at all on Sundays, won't be sufficient, as Nevada is squeezed by a drought that has escalated dangerously in 2021. In June, the state passed a law to rip up non-functional public turf in Las Vegas, such as grass planted beside roads or on roundabouts, over the next 5 years to save around 10% of city water use. That is just wasteful. The only person who walks on that is the person who cuts it, said Kay, jabbing a finger at a nearby grass verge median. Some people just want to recreate home where they grew up with grass. The new law, along with a financial incentive given to homeowners to replace thirsty grass with more hardy desert plants and rocks, is an acknowledgement that climate change won't easily allow the imposition of a verdant green oasis upon a bone-dry desert basin. A city that contains a huge replica of the Eiffel Tower, sprawling golf courses, and a simulacrum of Venetian canals complete with gondolas can never be said to fit in with its surroundings. But Las Vegas, Nevada, called the Meadows in Spanish due to its natural springs that were pumped dry by the 1960s, is at least aware of its setting in a place so arid that only a few small creosote bushes and tumbleweeds can survive here naturally. We live in the desert. We are the driest city in the United States, in the driest state in the United States, said Colby Pellegrino, deputy manager of resources for the Southern Nevada Water Authority. We have to act like it. Colby Pellegrino said the recent escalation of the drought has been very scary for some Las Vegas residents, although she insists the Water Authority has planned for this moment. Lake Mead's level dropped under 1,075 feet in June, barely a third full, triggering what will be the first ever cutbacks under a seven-state agreement on sharing the water from the Colorado River, which is harnessed by the Hoover Dam to create the reservoir. Different states get different water allocations, and Nevada is a victim of its depopulated history, getting just 300,000 acre-feet of water a year. By comparison, California gets 4.4 million acre-feet of water under an agreement stuck before the Hoover Dam was completed in the 1930s. The joke is that Nevada's representative was drunk, said Pellegrino, who was born in 1983 when the state's population was barely 900,000. It's now more than 3 million and receives tens of millions of tourists a year. The small water allocation will shrink by 21,000 acre-feet with the new cuts, although Nevada has made impressive strides in keeping below its low cap, slashing its water use despite the population nearly doubling since the early 2000s. Colby Pellegrino is confident that further savings can be made, and scrutiny is being placed upon the water used in Las Vegas's casinos' ubiquitous cooling systems. But global heating impact upon the West's snowpack and rivers is unrelenting, and the city's water savings will only go so far. Las Vegas only has a supporting role in its own fate. Three-quarters of allocated Colorado River water is used to irrigate thirsty agriculture, and the overall water supply is more dependent upon the amount of snow melting hundreds of miles away in the Rocky Mountains than some extra marginal savings made in the suburbs. Las Vegas has done great things such as ripping out the grass, but we've lost 20% of the flow of the Colorado River since 2000, and another 10% loss by 2050 is completely possible, said Brad Udall, a water and climate scientist at Colorado State University, whose research has focused on the stresses facing the Colorado River. I worry it could be even more than that, and that should frighten everyone. Back in Summerlin, Perry Kay is also relentless. A house opposite the first offender has broken sprinklers splurging water into the puddles on the grass and road. Perry Kay bangs on the ornate door to inform the homeowner, but no one is in. These sprinklers haven't popped up properly. They're just oozing everywhere, muttered Perry Kay. He has been policing water waste for the past 16 years, issuing countless fines in that time. I had hoped I would have worked myself out of a job by now, but it looks like I will retire first.
We are with you. What about you?